This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Christian Wiman. He's editor of Poetry Magazine. I spoke with him on March 21st, 2012, from the studios of APM in St. Paul, Minnesota. He was in the studios of public radio station WBEZ in Chicago. This interview is included in our show, Remembering God. Download the MP3 of that produced show at onbeing.org.
Hi, this is Christian Wiman. Sarah stepped out for a minute. Can you hear me?
Hi, Christian. It's Krista Tippett.
Hi, Krista. How are you?
Good. I'm so happy to have you at the other end of the microphone.
Oh, thanks for having me. I actually thought you were going to be here in the studio today.
Oh,
I didn't realize we were
no.
doing...
You know, there's a real intimacy to doing it this way, though, which I've come to appreciate. What the human voice alone conveys.
And you have to concentrate. I've done it a lot.
Yeah.
You have to concentrate a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's also that if that's all we have to work with, and then that's also, of course, all that the listener gets. So it's only fair.
Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, you know, you've been on our list for a long, long time. And then after you were on Moyers a few weeks ago, we just had this thunderous demand, and I know I wouldn't actually normally give in to something like that, just give in to something like that, but it felt right, so I'm glad to have you.
I know your show. I mean, I'll tell you a story. I was in the hospital getting ready for a bone marrow transplant in the fall, and I've listened to many of your shows, but I listened to all of the shows sort of one after another, because I had nothing to do. That's right. I was a captive audience.
Oh, wow. Well, that's...
But I loved it. You can't get the early years, though, or I couldn't get them on my computer. Is that...
Yeah, well, I guess there's the point at which podcasting started and things became MP3s. And then I think also real audio stopped working at some point. And we're actually going through right now, and we're going through this whole whatever they're doing. They're bringing the website back to life in a way, and that's part of it, is converting earlier things. It's funny, it's hard for me to listen to earlier shows, though, because, I mean, the interviews actually were the same, but the show's been very evolutionary, and I, you know, I've learned a lot also as the narrator person, so...
I'm sure.
I don't like listening to myself in those early years.
Does it feel like because you knew too much what you expected from people, or because it was too circumscribed?
No,
or?
I don't actually think the interviews, I mean, I think certainly I've gotten better, because you do get better at something you do a lot, you learn, but the interviews also yielded a lot of the same kinds of things. It's more how we scripted into the show. I was much more self-conscious when I was in that narrating mode, and what I thought I had to tell people for them to come into the conversation. And these days, we just really rest and let the conversation speak for itself. So
yeah.
It's kind of internal things that might not make sense to anybody else, but when you're in the industry. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm good. Mm-hmm.
Hey, Krista, this is Sarah. I'm the engineer at BEZ.
Hi, Sarah.
What I'm going to do, I'm mm-hmm. going to duck your levels coming back so that should mitigate some of the
okay.
noise.
It's very, in fact, I'm not hearing it right now, so I think we're okay.
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 So, Christian, the great thing about this format is we get to have a real conversation that may not necessarily be linear. What I thought I'd do, I've actually been really steeped in your prose as much as your poetry. And I mm-hmm. think the interview is going to revolve more around ideas that you've done in both places. But, if you at some point want to read a poem, then just please offer that and we'll do it. And then I thought at the end, I'd love for you to read a few that just for some reason are important to you now, or maybe have suggested themselves as relevant to what we've talked about.
Okay.
So let's just be spontaneous.
So she's
about
really
that.
She's fading in and out of my ear of my headphones.
Can you push your headphone jack in a little bit more?
Okay.
I'm going to have Christian push his headphone jack in a little bit more. Sometimes if you brush up against it, it gets a little.
All right, let's try that.
Okay. How am I fading still?
No, she's, I've got
that's
you
good.
Now.
Okay.
I heard everything. It was just fading in
yeah.
and out.
Okay. So should
the,
we?
The other thing, Krista, I just published, or actually it's coming out, well, it's out, but the publication date is next week of this, and I had them send you a copy, these selected poems of Osip Mandelstam.
Yes, I got that, yeah.
And there might be a poem in there that would fit in really well with something we talk about.
Yeah, do you have that with you?
I do.
Okay, great. Whatever you want to read whenever is fine.
Okay.
All right, well, should we go? Should we start? Okay. So, you don't always hear this when you listen to the program on the air, but I always start every conversation, whoever it is, if they're religious or not, by asking about their religious or spiritual background of somebody's childhood, which is such an interesting place for people to go. And I have to say, I always talk to people about this, and I've heard and read a lot of stories about, the interesting ways religion and spirituality get communicated to us as children. I have to say, Christian, that your story of all of them that I've heard all these years is the most familiar to me. And so, I want you to fill this out if I don't say it correctly, but I grew up not in West Texas, but in central Oklahoma. And growing up absolutely immersed in this religious universe, which meant everything, right? But then when I left that place, and like you, I went far, far away, it was the religious piece stopped to make sense as well, because it was the whole package.
Yeah, I think for me it was a big loss. I didn't realize exactly how large a loss for years, because I just, like so many people, dispensed with it. The way you change clothes or something, and became an agnostic or whatever you want to call it. But I wonder, I've got little kids now, and I do think about what I should teach them and how I should teach them in terms of their spiritual lives, because I greatly value the way I was raised, which was completely immersed in that culture. And
go to church like twice on Sunday and Wednesday night?
Yep. Sometimes even more. And we had to learn Bible verses and say them
over the hymns.
And
we had the hymns.
And had the singing. And there was no possibility of puncture to that world. I never met anybody who didn't believe until I went off to college. Never met a soul.
Right.
I remember the first time I met somebody, I half expected him to start swiveling his head around.
Did you know any Catholics?
Scared.
It's not even, it was like other kinds of Christians were.
I did have a good friend who was Catholic, and I went to, and we actually didn't have the bias against Catholics in my family for some reason. We didn't have that. But I certainly didn't know anyone who wasn't a Christian. And it's a good thing. I value the coherence of it, and I value the intensity of it.
Yeah.
And the momentum that it's given my life. But it's also created all kinds of difficulties, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there are a lot of people like us, though, in this country, and especially in, I don't know what we call the Bible Belt. But I'm not sure, when you get outside the Bible Belt, I'm not sure it's a narrative people recognize.
I think that's true. I have discovered that there is an enormous number of people in this country who are, they have some kind of religious language that's they're just unhappy with. It doesn't accord with their feelings of the sacred or their feelings of what spirituality means, and they're casting about for some new way of believing.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you can't just jettison everything that you have,
Yeah. Yeah, well, we'll talk about this some more. I also wonder about the origins of your life as a poet. In one of your essays, you start by saying when you were 20 years old, you set out to be a poet. But
right.
I guess I'm curious, too, about, where you see the inklings of that or the impulses or hungers or habits that were there earlier in your life that then somehow came to life at that point when you were 20.
Well, I certainly wrote when I was a little kid. I just didn't really know that there were poems. I didn't. My mother is a creative person. She would paint and she would write things herself. We weren't a family that read. There weren't books around, and But I did try to emulate the hymns that I heard, and I would write these little fragments of things and little songs. And in fact, when I was 6 or 7 years old, we went to the First Baptist Church in Dallas, which at the time was the largest Baptist church in the world. I don't know if it still is, but took up 4 city blocks, was this massive place. And the guy's name was his brother Criswell. I forget his first name, but they published the Southern Baptist Newsletter out of there. And it was just this enormous place. And at the end of the service, you know, they would have what I'm sure you grew up with. They would have the call for people to be saved. And and people would flood the aisles at this place because there were thousands of people in the congregation. And so one day when I was 6 or 7 years old, I left my family and ran down there. Didn't even tell them. They thought I was going to get saved. And I just handed him a poem that I had written. And the poem was, "I love the Lord and the Lord loves me. I will not forget and neither will he."
Wow.
The whole thing.
Wow.
And then it turned up in the Southern Baptist Newsletter. He published it. You know, I turned around and ran back, and he'd published it in the Southern Baptist Newsletter. And there's this little poem there, you know, when I was probably my biggest publication.
That's right. And I would bet that you were the only editor of Poetry Magazine who's ever had his first poem published in the Southern Baptist Magazine.
That's probably true. That's probably true. Although there have been editors who were very interested in theology. That Henry Rego was very interested in theology. Mm-hmm.
I mean, and then, of course, on another level, somewhere you wrote that your childhood was the very forge and working house of poetry. I mean, in terms of the raw materials of drama and pathos and emotion, I mean, your childhood was, there's so much violence in there, right? I mean, in your family.
Well, my family's very chaotic. You know, it's funny, I just had my nephew visiting me, and I feel like compared to his life, mine was a breeze. So it has continued that wave of difficulties. But yes, I think I would not say that I'd had a difficult childhood compared to a lot of the people I've seen since then, because I was loved by my family. And, you know, a lot of people grow up without love.
Yeah.
And I grew up with a great deal of love, and I think there was a lot of intensity and confusion and difficulty, and there was some violence, for the most part, my childhood was pretty good, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you have someone loving you, my things just went out.
And your mother watched her father kill her mother, or no, right? Kill.
My mother, that happened when my mother was 14. Yeah, mm-hmm. she watched her father came in and shot her mother, and my mother and her two brothers were sitting at the table, and it's really an awful story. She turned around and my grandmother, her mother, turned around and said, "Oh, Fred, no," you know, she realized what had happened. She got shot in the back, and the kids ran out. And then her father just lay down beside his wife and shot himself. And my mother moved from place to place. That happened when she was 14 years old. And all those kids got separated, and they lived very chaotic lives, but all ended up being successful.
Yeah.
Sometimes in quite dramatic ways. One of the brothers was a head of the University of Pennsylvania medical system, the whole thing. So they all, you know, emerged out of that, but not psychologically intact.
Mm-hmm. You know? I suppose what's just striking me right now as we talk is that story gets told, and it's very dramatic about that murder. But really what's astonishing about the story is, as you say, you were raised by this woman who went through that when she was 14, and she loved you, and that was this defining thing that she was able to do, despite that.
I was raised in a very masculine culture, and I was, you know, I played football and went hunting, and I got in tons of fights when I was a kid, I had that sort of masculine inclination and imperative in me and around me all the time. But when I look back at my life, it's my mother and my grandmother who really shaped me. Both of them, it's feminine consciousness is that I responded to. And both of them, my mother is a more educated person than my grandmother, and you know, conscious in a very different sense. But my grandmother had a kind of consciousness that really it took me a long time to understand, because I think many people would simply say it was unconsciousness. I mean, she lived within that religious culture that we talked about, that was completely saturated and defined by, you know, Baptist theology. But she also lived in her world in a way that is unlike, you know, anyone I've known since. Actually, she knew her world down to the least flower, the least creature that was in her yard, and every person that was in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a kind of, passive consciousness. And I like to use the word passive without any pejorative meaning, but a kind of passive consciousness that seems to me in some ways exemplary. And I think poetry comes out of that. And my mother's is different. Hers is more active. My mother's a force of nature. She storms into places. She's very dynamic, and she's very charismatic person.
Huh.
And she's the opposite of my grandmother. And that was sort of those two things mixed up together, I think, made a decent place to grow up as a poet.
You know, you say passive, but what I also think of is embodied, you know, conscious. I mean, physical, incarnational, almost. You could say that in consciousness that all manifests itself in physical reality and is in touch with that.
Yeah, I love that definition. Actually, I think that's a great definition of the way she was. And there's a section in this book that is about her.
Hmm.
Let me just
your
find
new
it.
Is this it. Your new book?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's this one section in this poem that you wouldn't know it exactly, that it's about my grandmother in the poem, but it is. And it says, "She who in her last days loved too well to lose a single weed to namelessness, in creosote, blue grama, goat's beard that is not thriving, is, amid the cattail's brittle whisper, whispers, 'Oh, law, honey, ain't this a praiseful thing?'" And so that in that section, she actually becomes those weeds that she knew so utterly. That's exactly what you were talking about.
So one thing I really like in your poetry, and I think it connects also to your faith, but I'd like to just think about it in terms of poetry first, also having just heard that, is this real tie to reality, which also gets intellectualized, the notion of reality. Do you know what I mean? Right? And I don't know, when I was reading through you, I also found a lot of reference to reality from Simone Weil. "It is necessary to have had a revelation of reality through joy in order to find reality through suffering." Or even in this essay you wrote, "Hive of Nerves," you talked about Christ using metaphors, but speaking the language of reality in terms of the physical world. And I wanted to know, and then I think back to the reality of your life. And now you are a poet and an intellectual, but you know a lot of really gritty reality. I mean, also there were other guns in there. I mean, you were with a friend when he shot his father in the face. That's reality.
Right.
It's not just the, I don't know, Simone Weil. I feel like when you hear her talk about reality, it can easily feel a little bit too philosophical.
Right.
So tell me about how you think poetry works with reality. You know, what is it about the language of poetry that helps us think about reality uniquely?
Well, I think, I have been sick lately, and I actually had a bone marrow transplant back in October and was in the hospital for quite a long time. And one of the things, poetry died for me for a while. I found that it just wasn't speaking to me, and I think I had certain expectations that it took me a while to realize were false expectations. I think we often talk about poetry getting us beyond the world, it taking us to the very edge of experience, and then getting us into the ineffable. And I have to say, when I was, you know, faced with the actual ineffable, I didn't want poetry that gave me more of the ineffable. What I wanted was some way of apprehending the world that was right in front of me that was slipping away. I wanted the world, you know, in front of my eyes. And the poems that I found useful were absolutely concrete. Sometimes not at all about religious things and not at all about spiritual things, but simply reality, and reality rendered in such a way that you could see it again. There's a great quote from the mid-20th century literary critic R.P. Blackmer. He's talking about John Berryman. He said that his work, you know, adds to the stock of available reality. It added to the stock of available reality. And that's a good way to think about what a real poem can do. It suddenly makes the amount of reality that you have in your life greater. It makes you're able to apprehend more of it.
You know, recently I was talking to a physicist, a string theorist, who's working with a new kind of mathematical language. I mean, I don't really profess to understand this, but he's essentially kind of doing with... He's taking mathematics beyond equations, and the analogy we were talking about is the difference between poetry and prose. And so the fact that there are truths you simply can't convey in a factual sentence, right? But that that poetry can, and he's kind of doing something similar with, it seems possibly that there are physical realities that you can't convey with an equation, but that a more visual mathematics might be able to convey.
Gosh, that's interesting. I think that's why physics is so fascinating to so many of the contemporary poets these days. It's there is some kind of reality that's being revealed that we can only reach through oblique ways. I think it reaches way back. It's why I'm drawn to mystics like Meister Eckhart and more contemporary ones like Simone Weil and language of apophasis, where you know what it is. You state something, but the statement sort of unstates itself. So that Meister Eckhart said, you know, we pray to God to be free of God. We ask God to be free of God.
Right.
And I don't think he wanted to, you know, give up his religion. The idea wouldn't have occurred to him, but he wanted to give up that idea of God as being this thing outside of our consciousness. And I think... one thing poetry can do is take us to those places where reality slips a bit. You know, what we think of as reality slips a bit, like those equations in physics, and suddenly we're perceiving something differently than before. And it's not all airy fairy mysticism either.
No,
It's quite angular and hard edged, and that's what I think the analogy is with physics and with physical science.
Yeah, it's almost like, I like that word you use, oblique. It's almost that things that in fact have been get diminished when they get captured in more straightforward language. That you can only even kind of evoke them with poetry, which is a different way of using language.
Yeah, it's a real balancing act, but how you find a language that can at once give voice to that kind of expression within us, which is what we're talking about, is very ineffable, you know, difficult to grasp, and yet can be coherent enough to bind a community together. And I think one of the frustrations I have with a lot of the churches I've gone to is they either forget about this or the issue doesn't arise. And the language is just too static, too mired in old ways of thinking about these things.
Yeah, God is pinned down in that language.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh. Or it's the opposite. It's all, you know, it's all so vague that I can't figure out what's going on. I can't figure out what God we're all trying to praise.
Yeah.
And I think it's very difficult to find a language that can do that. I have written in a couple of places that I wish, about poetry and how poetry could inform the liturgy and change the contemporary liturgy. I'm actually talking to a bunch of preachers this summer about this in a 5-day workshop near you, actually, near St. Paul.
Oh, really? That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Well, something that that was actually a complete revelation to me when I studied theology. After, you know, like you, I spent years of, I would never say that I was, you know, that I definitively said there is no God, but I didn't know what to do with it, and it didn't feel very actively relevant. But then when I actually went to divinity school, to learn that so much, so it seems to me what you're talking about there, talking to those pastors, is actually a return to the way, in fact, a lot of these truths are communicated in the Bible, which so much of it is in fact poetry. I mean, the book of Job is a poem.
Yeah, so much of the Bible is poetry.
And the Psalms. So it's in there. I mean, it's actually in the original text to rediscover.
Yeah. Yeah, we're not a culture that's very, very comfortable with poetry. I mean, you know, I grew up, those things were made absolutely literal.
Yeah.
I mean, just the most literal interpretation of those verses in the world. And that they're so clearly metaphorical. The truths are so obviously metaphorical. And if they're not understood that way by either side, then they're just destroyed, you know. Yeah.
So it's very interesting that your return to faith was very much connected to finding love. And I'm,
yeah, it was.
And you know, I'm resisting saying falling in love, because what I think of when I read the way you write about this and talk about this is you're not just actually describing something about faith. You're describing something about love that we forget, because we do throw it around so much, and it's something you fall into and fall out of.
Yeah.
But what you have really, really dug into, partly because you're a writer and you had these such dramatic experiences all at the same time, is, you know, love as something that puts us in touch with transcendence and with mystery. You were just really aware of that and articulate about it.
Well, I think, it was a revelatory time for me, because I certainly would never have said those things in the past. I had to have the experience to be able to write about it. In fact, I would have actively denigrated the notion, probably.
The notion of?
The notion that love could open up the world for you in that way. You know, we just published a poem in the magazine by a poet named Spencer Reese, who's become an Anglican priest, as it happens, and he's talking about the whole poem is an elegy for someone he knew, and is trying to get at the truth of his life, and he says, "All I know is that the more he loved me, the more I loved the world." Mm. And I think in any genuine love, and it's not simply romantic love.
Right,
any
it's other
love,
loves,
yeah.
Yes. It's our love for our children. Yeah, it's friendships.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's some kind of excess energy. We tend to think of love as closing out the world, and we can only see the face of the beloved, and you know, that everything else goes quiet or goes numb. But actually what I experienced was that, and I've experienced it again with my children, is that the love demanded to be something else. It demanded to be expressed beyond the expression of the participants. You know, it kept demanding more.
Yeah.
And that excess energy, I think, is God. Mm-hmm. I think it's God in us trying to return to its source. I think it's, I don't know how else to understand it, but if I think of myself as having returned to faith, and I do think of that, although I feel like I'm a desperately confused person, and when people look to me for advice or direction on faith, I just feel sometimes like it's hilarious. But I feel like it was that energy, a very positive energy, that drove me in that direction, not a fear of being destroyed. Those things, that was not it at all. It was an excess of life rather than a constriction of life.
Yeah, it's that way that, as you say, different kinds of love seem to put us in touch with something that's vital in ourselves that we might have forgotten, but also give us this larger kind of demanding sense of a greater sense to life itself, which easily points at God and religion.
Yeah, I think the difficulty then is, you know, how do you... The difficulty for me is how then do you acknowledge it in your life? You know, I think we have these experiences and they are... People react against the word spiritual these days. I don't know what other word to use at this point. They are spiritual experiences. And then religion comes after that. Religion is everything that we do with these moments of intense spirituality in our lives, whether it's whatever practice we have, whether it's going to church, how we integrate sacred texts into our lives. All that is religion, and all that comes after the fact, I think, after the fact of these primary experiences.
Yeah, I haven't actually, I don't know if I've talked to anybody about this, but a few weeks ago at the New York Public Library, I was, Pico Iyer was there, mm-hmm. and he was being interviewed, and he made this comment that I used to get asked this a lot. What's the difference between religion and spirituality? You know, and I don't know. I feel like I never come up with the right answer. But he said, spirituality is the water, is water, and religion is tea. What came to me is actually spirituality is water, and religion is the cup. It holds it. It carries it through time. That you drink from.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. What did he mean by tea?
I mean, what he meant is that you can live from water. That water sustains you. Water is what we need, and tea is just a little more complicated and flavorful. I think that's what he meant, right? That you've added something to it, but it's not necessary. But I like your way of saying that it's religion is what brings it in coherently into the fabric of life.
Yeah, and that if you think of it as a vessel, a cup, that makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. I don't quite understand his metaphor, but I do understand that as religion is a way of, you know, if it's not, you're not being religious, or taking on some sort of religious elements in your life, you're not necessarily saying I agree with everything that this religion says, or I agree with every, you know, it's very much, you're very much wrestling with it. I think what you are saying is that I've had these incredible experiences in my life of suffering or joy or both, and they have demanded some action of me and demanded some continuity of me. Mm-hmm. And the only way that I know to do this is to try to find some form in it and try to share it with other people.
I actually wanted to ask you about the words faith and belief, because you know, those are kind of used as the next stage from spirituality. But I like the way you talk about faith. My problem in our public life and even in our political life is then faith and belief, then it becomes a matter of opinions and ideas. And, you know, you've written, faith is not a state of mind, but an action, a movement, an action in the world, a movement towards the world, that mm-hmm. these are not abstractions.
I think of them, the way I've defined it to myself is I think of belief as having objects. I believe that Christ is the Son of Man. I mm-hmm. believe the world was created in 6 days. I believe that, you know, the universe is 5,000. I don't believe that this thing, but the world is 5,000 years old or whatever. I don't mm-hmm. believe that, but mm-hmm. but that's a belief. Faith doesn't have objects. Faith is an orientation of your life. It's an energy of your life, or, you know, however you want to define it. But I think it is objectless.
It doesn't have to be faith in, because that's how it gets, okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that has helped me to at least understand those terms somewhat and to explain to myself why I do need some sort of structures in my life. I do need to go to church. I need specifically religious elements in my life. I find that if I just turn all of my spiritual impulses, if I let them be solitary as I am comfortable in being, I'm comfortable sitting, reading books and trying to pray and meditating, inevitably, if that energy is not focused outward, it becomes despairing. It turns in on itself and I will look up in a couple of months and I find that I'm in despair. And so I think that one of the ways that we know that our spiritual inclinations are valid is that they lead us out of ourselves.
I also experience that people become spiritual in many different ways for different reasons, but often that the trajectory of that is often to move back towards some of the things that religion has always brought forward in time, like community, like it being communal and not just individual.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I think.
I mean,
your
story to me is very much an example also of this phenomenon of our time where we choose these things, where we create our spiritual lives, which is really new. I mean, you know, you were given this religious world as a center of gravity in your childhood, which a lot of people were until just a decade or two ago. And then there's the image I have of you and your fiancé standing outside this church. Was it right the day you got engaged?
That's right, and not going in.
Not going in, but then eventually deciding to go in.
Yeah. I think it's a perilous, difficult situation for people to, for everyone to be left on their own trying to choose
to have
their
charge
spiritual
of this.
Life. Right. And I think that's a lot of, you know, mid-century Protestant theology led by Karl Barth was a reaction against this.
Yeah.
That, you know, you can't simply trust your gut, trust your impulses, that we've got to have some way of finding God together. And, you know, for him, it was the Bible, and he was very conservative in certain ways, and I just cannot go there. I cannot follow. I disagree with much of Karl Barth's writings, although I've wrestled tremendously with it. And I can't, that neo-Orthodox
route. That orthodoxy, yeah.
Right. Even where I think it's impelled by liberal impulses, as Karl Barth was, but I just can't, I don't think it's the direction. I don't think we can just recover orthodoxy in that way. I think, I really feel that a whole new language is being created, and there's too many people who are struggling with this. And, I mean, traditional religious language is part of it and will be part of it, but a whole new thing is being created, and it's going to involve other religions, it's going to involve other practices, and I don't think you can simply resist it and say, you know, I'm going to just have my little corner and keep it safe and secure.
Mm. I think a lot about Dietrich Bonhoeffer in prison before he died extreme situation of having seen the church and orthodoxy and religious language be completely co-opted by evil.
Yeah.
But saying, you know, starting to talk about what would religionless Christianity look like, but also what saying that he thought that even as the language and the ideas might cease to be relevant, that the truths behind them would persist, and kind of what you just said, that new language and new forms would continually be recreated to express those.
Yeah. I love Bonhoeffer, and I'm struck by something else he said, that he said in a letter that he was often more drawn to atheists, and he had felt more fellow feeling with atheists than he did with his fellow believers.
Yeah.
And he was trying to understand that in himself. And I lost my train of thought. Just a second. You can edit this out, right?
Yeah. We can edit it, because I want to hear where it's going. Was it that he shared their questions or their impatience? I totally get that, but I don't remember that.
That quote?
Yeah.
God, I just forgot what I was going to say.
But so, you know, you're really vocal about your Christianity. But do you also feel that? Do you feel that? Is that a kinship with Bonhoeffer also? Because even more than him, you're surrounded by people who don't necessarily share your assumptions. I mean, just as a Western intellectual in the 21st century.
Yeah, I, you know, Bonhoeffer, I'm struck by, I find Bonhoeffer an incredible figure because, I mean, not simply because he returned to Germany when he could have had a safe life in the United States. He, you know, he returned and he felt like he, if he didn't do something, if he didn't share in the destruction of Germany, then he couldn't credibly participate in its restoration. Yeah. And he also simply felt that he had a call, and it's you know, it's very sobering to read his early books, the Cost of Discipleship, and yeah. and he talks about what it means to have a call. You know, he says only a person who obeys can believe.
Yeah.
That which is a hard statement. Mm-hmm. That you know, we wait for the right thing to do in our lives, but he says no, you've got to obey, follow that impulse, even as hazy as it is, and then your faith will come. You don't get it first. And you know, so he lost his life in that, but I'm particularly struck by Bonhoeffer because he not only did he say he had that fellow feeling with atheists, and he talked about religionless Christianity.
Yeah.
And he also said at one point, you know, we must be in a world with God has called us to be in a world without God.
Yeah.
Before God, and without God we stand with God. So despite all of that sort of quintessentially modern agony, spiritual agony, the feeling you get from Bonhoeffer is spiritual clarity. And this intense, just steel-like faith.
Yeah.
I mean, if you were looking for somebody, and he said, Christ is always stronger in our brother's heart than in our own, and meaning we need other people to sort of believe, to give our belief reality. We need to see it in other people. And you look at him, and you see such belief amid such despair. I find him such a wonderful exemplary figure of 20th century religion, theology. He even to me seems some of his statements have the feeling of poetry. They seem so
yes.
wonderfully suggestive.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you often quote George Lindbeck, who's a theologian.
Yeah.
And this is, I think a lot of people would be a little bit taken aback by this quote. You can no more be religious in general than you can speak language in general. And tell me what that means. I mean, that's something you've embraced. So tell me, what does that mean? What's that about?
Well, I do, that does make sense to me. Let me qualify it just mm-hmm. by saying, I feel very wary of saying what other people are able to do. Like I said before, I feel mm-hmm. myself very sort of confused in my own beliefs. And I find that, it's like we were talking earlier, if I don't have some kind of form, some coherent form and language in which to think of these intense experiences in my life that lead me to God, then they just sort of evaporate.
Yeah.
They just evaporate, and they become like, you know, little epiphanies in nature, or little, you know, wonderful little moments with my child, and wonderful, powerful things in my life, but not integrated in my life, and they don't seem to mean anything in my life, you know, cumulatively,
mm-hmm.
and I think that. I need some way of holding all this together, and Christianity is a way of doing it. I don't mean to suggest that it's just pragmatic, though, because I do believe in Christ. I mean, I call myself a Christian because I do believe that Christ was the embodiment of God, and that it was God suffering, God coming to earth to suffer. As we have suffered, I believe those things as I am able to, or I should say, I I try to turn my faith in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
I find if I just try to be my own individual spiritual self, nothing holds together. Nothing hangs together. Not only does it not hang together, it's palpably destructive in my life. I'd be better off without it.
Hmm. So, when you said a minute ago, you know, we're developing a new language. I mean, to me, that spiritual clarity, and in fact, you know, let's say Bonhoeffer also was Orthodox, certainly.
Yeah, he was very Orthodox.
You know, the spiritual clarity, Orthodox clarity, and what, for lack, want of a better word, we can call openness to reality, let's say. I feel like that's what we're grasping for now. But when you see in somebody like Bonhoeffer, those things were not in contradiction. It was.
There's pow, some.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's
and
some,
that's what you're describing in yourself. That.
There is some combination of austerity and clarity. I think that we as a whole culture are grasping toward, and the main movement of the culture is against it. All the political language, all that is just rot. The religious discourse that goes on in the political culture and on television and all these places.
Yeah, I don't take that. I just think that's an expression of its own self and not this. What we're talking about, which is
right. It's just
the real world.
It seems not to have anything to do with reality. But but I do think there's this huge cultural grasping toward clarity and austerity. I mean, something that won't be so, you know, frou-frou and slip out of our grasp and just make us think it's ridiculous, and yet also something that is open enough to engage those parts of us that we don't understand, that where we feel ourselves just drifting out of ourselves. You know, let me read one poem that I wrote. This poem. I wrote this, you know, several years ago after getting the diagnosis of having this incurable cancer. And at the time when I got the diagnosis, I got it about 6 years ago now. It looked very bad at the time. And, well, in fact, it's been bad, but at the time it looked bad immediately. And I was in despair once, and I wrote this poem. It's called From a Window. And because everyone's listening, I'll just tell you that the image that you see is a flock of birds taking off from a tree. Incurable and unbelieving in any truth but the truth of grieving, I saw a tree inside a tree rise kaleidoscopically, as if the leaves had livelier ghosts. I pressed my face as close to the pain as I could get to watch that fitful, fluent spirit that seemed a single being undefined, or countless beings of one mind, haul its strange cohesion beyond the limits of my vision, over the house heavenwards. Of course I knew those leaves were birds. Of course that old tree stood exactly as it had and would, but why should it seem fuller now? And though a man's mind might endow even a tree with some excess of life to which a man seems witness, that life is not the life of men. And that is where the joy came in. So I wrote this poem one day out of complete despair, and it exploded into this joy at the end. And, you know, I thought I was articulating despair, just giving a kind of cry to it, and the poem swerved into this joy. And I think when I talk about the kinds of experiences that lead us to God and that make us seek some sort of religious form for our lives, this is one for me. The writing of this poem, which which taught me something.
Hmm. Keep going. Did you?
I don't think the poem would, necessarily fits neatly into any religion. Exactly. it's not. You know, it's not. There is that word heavenwards, but you know, the concept of heaven doesn't mean much to me. I think it is simply an expression of the sense a lot of us have that our lives are more than our lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we have souls and that can very much go away if you stop attending to it. You can stop being able to feel that, and that's what had happened to me before I wrote this poem. And Seamus Heaney says that poems should be stepping stones in our lives. He meant for the poet that they are sort of incremental ways of understanding your life, of getting to the next step. I think it's true as a reader too. And this one was a big one for me. You know, I took a big step toward understanding what it was I believed in.
Yeah, so we're all mortal, but you have become much more aware of that than the rest of us are necessarily most of the time.
Yeah, I think I was talking with my wife about this earlier today. I think when it's really on you, when like I say, I had that bone marrow transplant in the fall, when you're really facing either something's going to work or this is it, your whole life just becomes this shape of, the size of a pin. I mean, you see everything through this pinhole, and that's all you can concentrate on. You know, your whole life is cancer or whatever it happens to be, and it's a very strange, disorienting feeling when that's taken away, actually, because suddenly it goes away, and you just immediately step back into your life, it's hard to live. It's very hard to live. It's hard to, I don't know whether it's a kind of post-traumatic sensation or whatever it is, but it's not easy to step from that situation of complete intensity and having everything circumscribed right back into your life, and not to feel yourself sort of really rattled.
I don't think we hear people talk about that very much. You hear about the other movement towards that clarity.
Yeah.
Because this illness you have is, it's very hard to predict the course of your health, right?
It's impossible to predict, and it seems to be different for every person.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people don't have to have transplants. I've had this transplant, and hopefully it will work. They're not really saying it's a cure, you know, hopefully it would be a long, long remission.
Yeah. You've written about, you talked a minute ago about how you don't use the word God in that poem, but it was about God. And I mean, God, just the word, well, not just the word, the idea. You've written about how it's difficult for modern people. And you wrote an essay about, you talked about it being at a dinner party. So you know, you talk about like existential anxiety, which is something that all the classic philosophers and theologians wrote about, even in the 20th century. You know, Niebuhr,
right?
Is our essential anxiety that's at the heart of the human condition. And I don't think we talk. When I'm reading you, I'm thinking, gosh, I don't think there are lots of people now who are right in the middle of things writing about this. But actually, what you helped me see is that. We do talk about this all the time, but we don't talk about it in that way. We talk about how our technology is driving us crazy, how we have to create downtime, and right, how we don't have space in our lives for what matters. It's just the trappings of this existential anxiety are very different and also very new.
We talk about we've deflected the soul into questions of the self. And there's a great quote from Fanny Howe where she talks about the self has replaced the soul with the fist of survival.
Mm.
That we've created a kind of climate in which to survive we all need to hone ourselves. And so right. we develop and hone ourselves, and we project those selves in all kinds of various ways, and whether it's Facebook or whatever we're doing, we think of our lives as being successful to the extent that those selves are ratified and by other people, and we've gotten away from the notion of the soul. It can be a real shock suddenly to think of the soul, which is apart from all of this and independent of it and primary. And I think it can be a real shock to find somebody who is suddenly talking about those things quite openly.
Right.
I find Marilyn Robinson wonderful in that way because she's she started out very obliquely. If you read Housekeeping, a lot of people that book seem to be more loved by secular people than by mm-hmm. religious people, but it's a Christian book to its core, and she's become much more direct in the way she's addressing these things. But I think it's quite bracing to read her, because she's become so famous, and yet she's addressing these timeless questions very directly.
What I'm aware of too is, even though we don't necessarily have vocabularies or places to talk about these things head on, or even to realize that that's what we're talking about, when it's presented like that, when Marilyn Robinson writes or when you are on Bill Moyers, people are completely drawn to that. Right? They recognize that they do want to be talking about this.
Yeah, starved for it. Just absolutely starved for it. I've been shocked by the response to that essay that I've been shocked by that interview that I did with Bill Moyers. I did it way back in December, and mm-hmm. they broadcast it recently, but the responses to that have just sort of caught me off guard. It's like we've talked about, there are just so many people. Well, I'm sure you get it with your show.
Every week it's,
there's so many people who are, just so desperate to have some kind of a language to discuss these things and to mm-hmm. feel these things. And, one of the reasons I am a Christian. I believe that Christ comes alive when we, in communion between people. And I think sometimes I'll think all kinds of things are wrong with my life. Like, my job is messing me up. My writing is messed up. Something's messed up. And then I'll have a conversation with someone about a religious topic or it's spiritually informed in some way and it's honest. And even if we don't get anywhere, even if we disagree, mm-hmm. The air has been cleared in me. And I realized that that in some ways that I was dealing with all these things that weren't the ground, weren't bedrock, that they weren't the ground of my being, and I'm trying to take care of things, the structures on top instead of the ground of my being, and I find that often all you need is some kind of conversation with someone. Even if it's just expressing pure anxiety.
Right, which just names that, even if it doesn't tie it up.
Exactly, uh-huh. exactly. Just names it and shares it, and that it can stabilize you in the world.
And I think that's something also that modern people will identify with in the way you talk about faith is about the animating aspect of doubt in that, even in your prayers. Even in the act of going to church. It's not something separate. Yeah. It's not a problem. It's just part of it.
Well, there's this other poem. Let me read this other poem that you can think of immediately adjacent to From a Window. It's from the same book, Every Riven Thing. It's not adjacent to it in the book, but it is in my mind. It's called Hammer is the Prayer. "There is no consolation in the thought of God," he said, slamming another nail in another house another havoc had half taken. "Grace is not consciousness, nor is it beyond. To hell with remembrance, to hell with heaven. Hammer is the prayer of the poor and the dying." and as wind in some lordless random comes to rest, and all the disquieted dust within, peace came to the hinterlands of our minds, too remote to know, but peace nonetheless. I wrote several poems after that, From a Window. From a Window was one of several poems that seemed to me to express some sort of real belief that I could build on.
Yeah.
And then I wrote these other poems that seemed to just repudiate it all and seemed to give up all the gains I had made. And like this one where, God is actually, expunged from this poem. There is no consolation in the thought of God, this poem starts. And I wrote others that, not only did they not credit the idea of heaven, they actually mocked the notion, made fun of it. And I didn't do this purposefully. I mean, the poems got written, they happened to me. And so I sort of looked up in the aftermath of them and, thought, what in the world is going on? Why am I writing these? And I think it's very much what you said, that doubt is so woven in with what I think of as faith that it can't be separated. And the strange thing is that I didn't feel different writing these poems than I did writing From a Window.
Right.
I felt that same access of energy. And I am convinced that the same God that might call me to sing of God at one time might call me at another to sing of godlessness. And that sometimes when I think of all of this energy that's going on, all of this, what we've talked about, these different people trying to find some way of naming and sharing their belief, I think it may be the case that God calls some people to unbelief in order that faith can take new forms.
Mm. And can't you also see it as continuity? I mean, let's go back to the idea that you discovered love at the same time that you discovered faith. In a mature relationship, in love as in faith, the feeling isn't always there, right? That initial clarity and intensity is not a constant part of actually being vital and growing. But it's part of the health of the thing.
Yeah, I think that's... I hadn't thought of that, but that's helpful for me to think of it that way.
If we're grown-ups about this stuff, right? If we're grown-ups about faith, then...
Then why can't we have... Right, why can't we all get together and lament the fact that there's no God? The Bible is actually full of moments like that too.
Yes.
I think that is part of any mature faith. You're right. But I like so many people, tend to fall into despair at those moments and think, oh my God, I don't believe in anything.
We fall into those moments of despair in our love relationships as well, right?
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, you were quoting Seamus Heaney about writing poetry. But it seemed to me that this also applies to the life of faith. And, I like the way you also took it to this grand level. I mean, maybe it's the life of faith and life of an individual. Maybe it's our culture over a few hundred years. you said, compose in darkness, expect aurora borealis in the long foray, but no cascade of light. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. Heaney is if people haven't read him out there, he's one of the... greatest poets alive, and he's been an exemplary model for me because he's a poet who's grown throughout his life in terms of his poems, but he has also opened himself up to very different things. He says in one poem, me waiting to 50 to credit the miraculous or the marvelous, maybe it is, I forget what it is, he was quite late in his life until he allowed this what I would think of as a spiritual energy or into his work. It's a very different sort of energy than the concrete physical reality of his early poems.
something that I'm really aware of that just is it is another dimension of this spiritual hunger that we've been talking about is we now have people living so much longer. And I was speaking in Sun Valley, Idaho, a couple of years ago, which is a place where a lot of people are living when they're retired, you know, in that a latter stage of their life when they wouldn't even have still been alive a couple of generations ago. And somebody mm-hmm. asked me about, you know, said how thrilling it is to be a seeker, a spiritual seeker in your 80s. And I realized that this is a whole new human phenomenon. And it's so interesting, you know, it's very different when people are having this experience in their 80s than when they're in their 20s. It's very rich. You know, it's very exciting, I think, for us as a culture for that to be going on.
Do you think, so did that person express any anxiety about that? Or was it a sort of a purely
it was
pure
like a liberation. I think it's partly it's a generation where of people who, when they were younger, grew up in those religious worlds like you and me, where there were no questions and a lot of nourishment and meaning. But they've gotten to this later stage of life where they've lived through so much, so they have so many raw materials for theology and for questions, and they're not necessarily throwing overboard the faith that they've held through their lives, but they're empowered to be questioning and learning new things in a way that they weren't empowered when they were younger. And it's really thrilling. They're really excited.
That's interesting. Gosh, I would like to reach a stage where I could rest a little.
Yeah.
I would like it not to be so quite so vertiginous. You know,
yeah.
So,
but you're in your 40s, right? You're,
Yeah.
I wonder, it struck me when I was thinking about talking to you that there's a lot of language about death in religion and in poetry. And I wonder if some of it feels, I mean, how your perspective on that has changed, being, as we've said, a person who's more conscious of his own mortality than most of us. I mean, you've faced death as, you know, as possibly something in the near term. And, you know, death and transcendence, death and beauty, death and death as a choice, death and discovering what really matters. Do you hear those kinds of, that kind of language differently now?
I sure do. I hear that kind of carpe diem language. There's a famous line from Wallace Stevens, "Death is the mother of beauty." You know, meaning that we can't ever perceive our lives until we look through it through the lens of death. But if you look through it through the lens of death, then it's suddenly much more abundant and beautiful and sharp. And I have come to think that is just a load of crap. I think anyone who could write that line was someone for whom death was an abstraction. And, you know, a kind of pleasant abstraction, actually, that as it is, death is an abstraction for all of us. And even if you get, as I have been, you know, close to dying in the last year, even if you get that close, it is still an abstraction, not as much of an abstraction, but you simply cannot imagine your own death, and the mind will not do it, and you can't quite do it. I think that that we actually have to have the past and the future if you think about it, we have no present. You know, we're always remembering. There is no actual present, just the way reality is. It takes that long for our brains to process the instant. We're always remembering events, and we're always projecting some sort of future. And I think that's where meaning, that's how we get meaning in our lives. And if you take that away from someone, if you take futurity out of the equation, any sense of futurity, then I think you just you leech meaning out of an experience just as surely as if you just cut out somebody's past entirely, you cut out their memory. And I think what that poem From a Window that I read, what that poem showed me, revealed to me, was some possibility of a continuation, you know, the spirit continuing. And I find that for me, I had to look at, let's see how to phrase this. It was somehow, I didn't find that a secure, or exactly a peaceful thing. It's not as if I imagined walking in heaven and meeting all my relatives and, you know, it being this warm, comforting thing. But I do, I feel more that my imagination keeps opening onto these eccentric heavens. And I have to give them credit. I have to give them their due. I'm much more moved. I think if you think of someone like Wallace Stevens, he sat back and said, "Death is the mother of beauty. Hence, from her shall come fulfillment to all our dreams and our desires." It's very distant. It's very detached. It's a very abstract notion of how we live our lives. I'm much more moved by someone like the Russian poet Osip Mandelstam, and I happen to just have translated his selected poem, a few of his poems, and let me read you this. This is the last poem that Mandelstam wrote. Now, Mandelstam was hounded to death by Stalin, and one of the reasons was he wrote a famous poem that was a mockery of Stalin, which he recited to some friends, and in those days, people could... they were so used to hearing poetry and reciting poetry that they could hear it once and keep it, and someone keep it in their heads, and someone memorized the poem from his recitation and then took it to Stalin, and his fate was sealed. But in fact, it was sort of sealed long before that, because there was something about Mandelstam that drove Stalin insane. There was a kind, I think it was a kind of irrepressibility and freedom and pure lyric genius that was everything that Stalin could never fully repress, you know, that he just could not fully control. And so so here's the last day of Mandelstam's writing life, not the last day of his life. He died in a transit camp not long after this, picking through garbage was the last anyone saw of him. And he knew what was about to happen to him. And he knew all too well, and he was composing these poems right up until the end. The last day he died, he wrote either two or three poems, depending on how you put these poems together, but this was one of them. "And I was alive in the blizzard of the blossoming pear. Myself I stood in the storm of the bird cherry tree. It was all leaf life and star shower, unerring, self-shattering power. And it was all aimed at me. What is this dire delight, flowering, fleeing, always earth? What is being? What is truth? Blossoms rupture and rapture the air, all hover and hammer, time intensified and time intolerable, sweetness raveling rot. It is now. It is not." Now that seems to me an incredible expression of hope and persistence, and you know, Seamus Heaney says somewhere, you know, hope is not a condition of your soul. Hope is a condition of your soul, not a response to the circumstances in which you find yourself. I'm mangling that somehow. But think of it, and think of Osip Mandelstam writing this, knowing what he was going to, and compare that with Wallace Stevens sitting back and saying, "Death is the mother of beauty."
Right. Well, and I keep that line you said a minute ago, the eccentric heavens, I also hear that there.
Yeah, these strange ways, that strange sort of ways of surviving seem to keep occurring to me, though if you ask me, do I believe in heaven? No, I don't really believe in heaven in the way that people conceive of it. And yet it somehow keeps asserting itself in my imagination.
Right. So if I ask you to think about yourself in church all those years ago in West Texas, the church you grew up in, which was just given to you like the air you breathed, and then when you're in church now, yeah, what's going on that's different? How is that experience different?
Well, it's utterly different. It's utterly different. I think it's a weaker experience now. I mean, I'm just too conscious. I'm unable to let myself. I wish I were able to let myself go in ways that those people did in my childhood and still do. And when I go to my mother's church now, it's one of those big mega churches. And I don't agree with everything. I don't agree with their theology, and I don't like a lot of the ways that they commercialize their services. But it is an incredibly diverse church, and the people are intensely involved mm-hmm. with their... They're treating it as if their whole life were at stake. And in the churches I go to, liberal Protestant churches, it seems pretty casual. Mm-hmm. You know, it lacks that intensity, and I really miss that intensity.
Hmm.
I'm not going to go to a huge church and get intoxicated, but I do miss it.
Hmm.
I wish there were some credible middle ground. I wish there were some way of harnessing the intensity that I felt in my childhood in more sophisticated ways.
That may be another way of describing what the new language that we talked about that a lot of people now are searching for. It's not just new language, it's new forms, right?
Yeah, and I think art has a big role to play in that.
Mm.
You know, art the encompassing art, poetry and music and just the experience of art.
Say some more. Even like this discussion you're going to have with pastors about bringing poetry into liturgy in a different way. That kind of thing.
Well, I think that, if I think of some of the most intense experiences in my life, they are artistic experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And not simply making art, but responding to it. And I think if a church could allow those experiences to happen without necessarily putting them in place and saying they have to be... You know, they mean this in our liturgy, or they represent
right.
this.
Right, they get very self-conscious, when people just
right.
inject art into worship.
Right.
That's the danger
yeah.
there. You're talking
yeah,
about
but
it
I've
being part
I've
of
seen
the
it done well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've seen it done well where it is just... In fact, I'm just coming from a... I was out on Whidbey Island at mm-hmm. a conference, and the people there put on... I guess the students did. They put on a sort of makeshift... service, and it was made up of songs that clearly had been written by one of the people there and had just sort of been set to music on the spot, and there was a poem, and it was unlike any service that I had been to. They just sort of did one thing after another, which were all addressed to God, and that was the service. And I found it very beautiful, very moving, sort of the perfect thing for me.
Hmm. In the preface to Ambition and Survival, this collection of writings, which was 2007, so it was a few years back, you wrote, "I still believe that a life in poetry demands absolutely everything, including, it has turned out for me, the belief that a life in poetry demands absolutely everything." Would you tell me what you mean when you say that?
Oh, no. What a paradox.
Or do you... it's 5 years ago, so maybe it's not still true. But if it is, what is it? What do you mean? I'm trying to wrap my mind around it.
For years, there's a poem I love by a Canadian poet named Robert Bringhurst, and it starts like this: These poems, she said, are poems with no love in them. These are the poems of a man who would leave his wife and child because they made noise in his study, she said. These are the poems of a man who would murder his mother to claim the inheritance. These are the poems of a man like Plato, she said, meaning something I did not comprehend, but which nevertheless offended me. These are the poems of a man who would rather sleep with himself than with women, she said. These are the poems of a man with eyes like a draw knife, hands like a pickpocket's hands, woven of water and logic and hunger, with no strand of love in them. These poems are as heartless as birdsong, as unmeant as elm leaves, which if they love only the wide blue sky and the air and the idea of elm leaves. Self-love is an ending, she said, not a beginning. Love means love of the things sung, not of the song or the singing. These poems, she said. You are, I said, beautiful. That is not love, she said rightly. I didn't mean to quote that whole thing, but for years I carried that poem like it was a kind of totem in my mind. It was just, it expressed to me so perfectly what sort of tensions that I felt between my life and my life as an artist and my life. And I felt that I was giving everything to poetry, and you had to give everything to poetry, and yet at the same time I felt some sort of essential energy missing from some of my poems. I had to eventually give up that notion that you could give your whole life to poetry, that poetry could be this abstract thing that you could devote your life to. I mean, I'd made a god. You talk about idolatry. I'd made a god out of it. And I had to have that shattered in order to come to write some of the poems that are in Every Riven Thing. I had to really have that notion tested severely.
And do you feel that these new poems do better integrate your life as a poet and life?
Definitely, yeah.
It's funny, I feel like what you're describing, a lot of lives have that tension. You can replace the word poetry with, you know, whatever someone's work is or...
Right.
You know, their whatever relationships they've invested in to the exclusion of other things.
Difficulty of art is that it's the emotional intensity that you need to give to art is asked for by other people, and you often, I had the sense that life was fuel for art. That you know it just got burned up in using it and because it's not a question of time. You know, you could sometimes spend an hour a day writing poems. It doesn't, you know, you can't sit there for 12 hours and try to write poetry.
Yeah.
It's a question of emotional availability and just, you know, how much you can give yourself over to life if you're giving yourself over to waiting for poems. I have found that I've, you know, greatly changed that. You know, somebody may come along in the future and say his work falls apart right at that instant, and and it's a downhill slide after that. That has happened to many writers. So I'm not the one to say.
I think I'd like to end by having you read at least maybe one of the poems or maybe more that illustrate what you just said, the place you've come to where that paradox is less agonizing. But is there anything that I feel like it's been such a beautiful conversation and we've gone in a lot of places, but is there anything that you feel like you wanted to say or you want to add that I didn't ask about?
I'm not thinking of anything. Okay. I mean, we've covered a lot.
It's going to be fun for me to listen to this because I'm in it, right? So, but I know. I mean, it's been wonderful.
Let me read a little poem that's to my wife, and you could put it right next to that poem that I just quoted by the Canadian poet Robert Bringhurst. That poem is called These Poems. This poem is called 4D. Groans going all the way up a young tree, half cracked and caught in the crook of another. Pause. All around the hill-ringed, heavened pond, leaves shush themselves like an audience. A cellular stillness, as of some huge attention bearing down. May I hold your hand? A clutch of mayflies banqueting on oblivion writhes above the water like visible light. That's a little love poem. It's a poem of, I think, equanimity. You know, it's a poem of of almost peace in face of that oblivion. Do you want any others?
Yeah, sure. I was thinking it might be a poem your grandmother would like too.
That's true. You know, I when I set out to write my first book, I wanted to write a big part of that book is actually in the voice of my grandmother, a sort of composite woman that I created out of different voices, but it's mostly her voice. And I wanted to write something that they could understand. I wanted it to have all different levels. I mean, I didn't want to simplify it and write a simplistic poem, but I wanted to write something that they could understand. Mm-hmm. She died before I finished it. I actually read part of it to her, and she was on her deathbed. I don't know if she heard it or not. Mm. Let's see. Here's a poem of here's a poem that you might think of as a kind of reproach to that self that was so enamored by the notion of giving all to art and also of suffering. It's called "And I Said to My Soul, Be Loud." That is from T.S. Eliot. Says, "And I said to my soul, be still." And I turn that around. Madden me back to an afternoon I carry in me, not like a wound, but like a will against a wound. Give me again enough man to be the child choosing my own annihilations, to make of this severed limb a wand, to conjure a weapon, to shatter dark matter of the dirt dauber's nest, galaxies of glass. Whacking glints, bash dancing on the cellar's fire, I am the sound the sun would make if the sun could make a sound, and the gasp of rot stabbed from the compost's lumpen living death is me. Oh, my life, my war in a jar, I shake you and shake you, and may the best ant win. For I am come a whirlwind of wasted things, and I will ride this tantrum back to God until my fixed self, my fluorescent self, my grief-nibbling, unbewildered, wall-to-wall self withers in me like a salted slug. You can tell what my childhood was like.
I love that.
We used to have all kinds of battles in jars between scorpions and tarantulas and ants. And
yeah, I grew up in that part of the world, too. I know. Everything was poisonous.
Yeah.
Up here in the north, they don't believe you. Oh, I think that's great. If you want to read one more, that's fine, or we can finish. It's so good.
Okay, let me see if there's... Here's one that's set in Chicago. And this is just, I live on the north side, and this is just a poem, me sitting at my window looking out of onto our front lawn with my dog. Albany Park is where we live. It's called "It Takes Particular Clicks." Flip-flops, leash clinks, spit on the concrete like a light slap. Our dawn goon ambles past, flexing his pit bull. And soft and soon a low burn lights the flight path from O'Hare. Slowly the sky, a roaring flue to heaven, slowly shut. Here's a curse for a car door stuck for the umpteenth time. Here a rake for next door's nut to claw and claw at nothing. My nature is to make of the speed bump scraping the speeder's undercarriage and the ohm of traffic and somewhere the helicopter hovering over snarls a kind of clockwork from which all things seek release, but it takes particular clicks to pique my poodle's interest. naming with her nose's particular quiver the unseeable, unsayable squirrel. Good girl. That's a religious poem, if you get right down to it. It's a poem about her spiritually superior instincts.
Well, I think we're done. I think we're going to put this on the air pretty quickly for us. Okay. And we'll let you know, give you all that detail, and we might have some questions. I assume you've been emailing with somebody.
I haven't, actually, but...
Is that all going to your publicist?
Yeah, but it can go directly to me.
Okay.
It's easier if it goes to me.
What's your email address, then?
C. Wyman at poetrymagazine.org.
Okay. So we'll start writing to you directly there.
Okay.
All right. This was such a pleasure.
Great to talk to you, Krista. I'm a real fan.
Great.
I'm a real fan. Well, hope we meet
really
in person sometime.
I do, too. So I'll write you an email. Okay. Take care. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.